Again, we have been granted another opportunity by our Father in heaven to come here for a few moments to sing songs of praises to His name, honor, and glory, to petition His throne of mercy and grace, to remember His Son's death upon the cruel cross of Calvary in just a few moments, and to spend a few times together to study His Word. Let me take this opportunity, if you're visiting with us, to let you know that we are happy and pleased that you're here. We hope you're here for one purpose and one purpose only, and that is to worship the Father in spirit and in truth. If you feel that anything that is done or said this morning does not comply with that simple teaching that we have in John 4, verse 24, we would count you as a dear friend if you would come to us, that we might sit down with an open Bible and an open mind and come to thus saith the Lord. I'm thankful to see some of you back that have been ill, but still many of our number are ill. We need to remember them in our prayers that they might be able to shake this cold and flu bug that has been plaguing this place for the last 5 or 6 weeks. I don't know if you noticed in the bulletin last Sunday that in the month of February, and it carried on last week and it looks like it's carried out today, that we've averaged at least 20 people every service in the morning being gone in the last 6 weeks. I will be glad when spring gets here for more reasons than I can say. But please keep our number who are ill in your mind. And Brother Harvey will be making announcements. I don't want to take anything away from what he has to say. But there is one particular thing I would like to ask, and that is that you remember Paul Savage. If you have some time, please go by and see Paul. He loves visits. You don't have to stay long, but he enjoys it. And he is not doing as well since they have moved him. And I want you to remember him in your prayers. Before I get into the lesson this morning, I have a couple things that I would like to mention to you as far as my part of the work that I would like to ask your help in. First of all, there's two lists on the board, one for the Fishers of Men class and one for the home Bible study. We need two more families to sign up for the Fishers of Men and three families to fill up the home Bible study classes. I'd like to take those lists off the board because there's other things that I need to place up there. I would ask on your way out this morning that you would go and look at those lists. And if you have the desire to do that, please sign up that we can have all the lists filled for the remainder of this year. If you have any questions about the classes, you can ask those who are on the list taking the First Fisher of Men's class and the home Bible study class. Ask them how they like it. Ask them about the class, and I'm sure you'll get an honest answer. If they tell you they don't, come back and let me know, and I'll need to know that. I'll have to have a talk with them. But realistically, please ask them. I want to commend you for your opportunity to do this. It is a lot of work, but I believe the Lord will be blessed in our efforts. So please take a look at those lists and sign them up that we might be able to take them off the board. Also, our young people, you have 3 weeks from today to get your articles in for your May issue of the Messenger. I want to just remind you of that. I don't want that time to slip by that you forget. I need to have your articles by April the 4th to give my proofreader time to be able to get that back to me. So please, mindful of that. You did an excellent job in your articles last year in March. And just as a by thing of that, I want you to know the request for the issues of the Messengers last year, I had more requests for the articles of the young people than any issue that we did last year. And that you'll be commended for that, and I hope that you'll do the same good job this year. And one other note, on the bulletin board this evening, there will be a meal list for Brother Ward for our upcoming meeting. Our meeting is 1 month from today. I hope you notice these blue flowers I put on the door. They're reminders about our responsibility in this matter. And I hope that you'll take time to read that flyer, and you'll make your plans to be here each and every night, beginning April the 11th through the 16th, as Brother Jim Ward from Bowling Green, Kentucky, will be holding and conducting our gospel meeting. I hope that you're making your plans to be here. In Psalms, the 8th chapter, and in verse number 4, the psalmist writes, "What is man that you are mindful of him, and that the Son of Man that you visit him?" This is an expression of astonishment that God, the creator of this world, would not simply ignore man, but really give him any second thought and would be mindful and concerned about his well-being. Yet, what other of God's creation could even ask such a question? What other of God's creation could ever question God and ask him why he is mindful of man and why does he visit man? This topic is a crucial part of our discussion together on the Bible doctrine of sin. In order to have a correct understanding of what the Bible teaches about sin, we must take into account the nature of man. What makes man what he is, and what is man's nature? As we will see, there has been great controversy concerning the account of the nature of man. Other than angels, there is no other part of God's great creation whom sin applies to other than the creation of mankind. Only man needs to ask the question pertaining to sin and what it does and what is our responsibility towards it. But in order to answer this question thoroughly and completely and scripturally, we must inquire about the relationship between the nature of man and that of sin. How is man capable of sin? And how does sin affect his life? Why do people sin? And is sin an inevitable conclusion? These questions need to be answered, and they need to be answered according to the Scriptures. Man is the height of all of God's earthly creation. Man was placed in charge of all that God created. If you take your Bibles out and turn to the first chapter of the book of the Bible of Genesis, I want to read with you verse 28 and 30 of chapter 1. Then God blessed them. God said to them, "Be fruitful and multiply. Fill the earth and subdue it. You have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the birds of the air, and over everything that moveth and creepeth upon the earth." And God said, "See, I have given you every herb that yields seed which is in the face of the earth, and every tree whose fruit yields, also to every beast of the earth, and to every bird of the air on the earth in which there is life. I have given you every herb for food," and it was so. God gave man dominion. In Hebrews, the second chapter, in verse 5, we read the same statement, but made in a little different way, beginning in verse 5. For he has not put the world to come to which we speak in subjection to angels. But one testified in a certain place, saying, "What is man that you aren't mindful of him, and the Son of Man that you take care of him? You have made him a little lower than the angels. You have crowned him with glory and honor, and you set over the works of your hand, and have put all things in subjection under his feet." We need to understand that man was God's epitome of his creation. He was the greatest of all the things that God created when he created the heavens and the earth. The crowning part of that creation was you and me. And mankind is his greatest evidence of his existence. And we need to understand that Jesus came in the form of a man. And Jesus came in the form of the man, and not this week, but next week we will talk about temptation. And there is a great misunderstanding about the subject of temptation and how it applies to all of mankind and how it applied to Jesus. But this morning, for a few minutes, and also this evening, I want to talk to you about the sin and the nature of man. How does sin relate to the nature of man, and what are we about, and how are we made up? If you don't understand the nature of man correctly, you're going to come up with an unscriptural understanding of how sin affects us. But I believe the Bible is quite clear about the nature of man, and I want to look at some things with you today that I hope that will help encourage you to have the proper understanding about this nature. I want to begin by talking about the nature of man, and I want to talk about the Bible record in reference to what some in the world teach about the nature of man. I want to begin by telling you that man is a spirit. Man is a spirit, and that is contrary to materialism. Man was made in the image of God. Turn to Genesis again, the first chapter, in verse 26, a passage that you should be very familiar with. In verse 26, it is recorded, "Then God said, let us make man in our image, according to our likeness. Let him have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the birds of the air, and over the cattle, and over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps upon the earth." We see that male and female are images of the flesh. But these are clothing, or they are a tent, or they are draped over the inner man, over the spirit of man. And the inner person, the spirit of man, is that which reflects the image of God. This earthly tabernacle does not reflect the image of God. It is the inner person. It is the spirit that is made in the image of God. In the second chapter of the book of Genesis, in verse 7, in talking about the creation of man, the statement is said, "And the Lord God formed man out of the dust of the earth, ground, and breathed in his nostrils the breath of life, and man became a living soul." There are two parts to every human being: the flesh, the blood, and the spirit. And the flesh and the blood were made from the dust of the ground. Every part of man is made of flesh and blood, save the inner man. And in Psalms chapter 16, in verse number 10, we are told in the prophecy concerning Christ that there is a part of man that lives beyond the grave. There is something that lives beyond the grave. We are told in John chapter 4 and verse 24 that God is a spirit. All that worship Him must worship Him in spirit and truth. God is not like man. Let me say that again. God is not like man. God does not have a body of flesh and bone. That is materialism. The Bible does not teach that God is a created being. God is eternal, which simply means that He has always been, that He has no beginning, no ending. When we have a spirit, our spirit is not like God, not yet, not in its full sense. But it will be, according to 1 John 3, verse 2, when we see Him, we will be like Him. But right now, we have an added burden over the inner man. We have the added burden of flesh and blood. We need to understand the fleshy image of man cannot reflect the image of God. Now let me say that again. The fleshy image of man cannot reflect the image of God. Now, that doesn't mean our character can't. That doesn't mean our attitudes can't. And that doesn't mean our actions must. But this flesh does not represent deity. It is what's inside of me and what's inside of you that represents the image of God. We need to also understand in Romans, the first chapter, and in verse number 23, Paul tells the Gentiles of a grave mistake that they had made in their thinking. And this same mistake is still being made by men today. "And change the glory of the incorruptible God into an image made like corruptible man, and birds and four-footed beasts and creeping things." You cannot form God to be like us. That's what man continues to strive to do. He tries to bring God down to his level. It cannot be done. There is a difference. There is a stark difference between us and God. He is greater. He is purer. He is wiser. He is more noble. There is not anything in any way that we can equal the majesty and the grandeur and the wisdom of the God of heaven. And we need to accept that. But that does not mean that we do not have an inner quality that is made in the image and the character of God. 430 years. After Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob had departed the scene and were dead and were buried in the ground, God lived as a spirit. And these men lived as spirits. If you'll care to read Exodus chapter 3 and verse 6 and Matthew the 22nd chapter and verse 29 through 32. God's image is reflected in man's spirit being, and is reflected in his intelligence, in his will, in his ability to discern, and his moral obligation and moral capacity. You see, man was created with moral capacity. What did I mean by that? What I mean that man was created with moral capacity, it means he doesn't have to act like an animal. He doesn't have to act like he can't control himself. He can't have control over his instincts. He can't have control over his body. And he's not to act like an animal. But you see, the humanist theory has so permeated our society that when you look around, you don't see too much difference between the way animals act and the way human beings act. That's because humanism has taken over the theory in the minds of men that they are just a higher form of an animal. That is a lie. The Bible doesn't teach it, and in truth, creation itself will teach that that is a lie. Because we are made in the image of God, we have the ability to choose and make right decisions. I give you as an example Adam and Eve. In the very beginning in Genesis chapter 2, in verse 16 and 17, God gave them a moral obligation. He told them, of every tree of the garden, thou mayest freely eat, but of the tree of knowledge of good and evil, in the midst of the garden, thou mayest not eat, for in the day that thou eat of it, thou shalt surely die. Man had the moral capacity to obey that commandment. He not only had the moral capacity to, he had the obligation to, if he wanted to be pleasing to his Creator. But materialism, it has a much different view than what we read in the Bible. Materialism is the view that man is a body without an inner being, without an inner spirit. And many teach this. This doctrine and theory is taught by atheists. It's taught by evolutionists. It's taught by the Seventh-day Adventists. It's taught by Jehovah Witnesses. It's also taught by the Worldwide or Seventh-day Church of God that was started by Herbert W. Armstrong. And many others still take that position that there is no inner quality of man. There is no inner spirit. Some deny the spirit, but they affirm the resurrection. How? How could a person deny the spirit and affirm the resurrection? In Matthew, the 22nd chapter, and verse 23 through 32, Jesus himself taught that if the resurrection is a true biblical doctrine, that it's a necessity that man have a body of flesh and an inner being. Do you remember what Jesus himself said? I want you to turn to Matthew 10. I want you to look at the words of our Lord in verse 28. And do not fear those who can kill the body, but cannot kill the soul. But rather fear him who is able to destroy both body and soul in hell. Brethren, Jesus made a distinction. Man can kill this flesh. He can put it to an end. But he cannot kill the soul and the inner part of man. Only one person has the ability to destroy and punish the soul, and it is God. That makes man a two-natured being. He is man as flesh and blood, and he is spirit as the inner man that has the ability to choose and to make the distinction. In Acts, the 23rd chapter, and in verse number 8, the Apostle Paul makes the argument, for the Sadducees say that there is no resurrection and no angels or spirit. But the Pharisees confess both. Brethren, there is a resurrection. But if there is no inner man, if there is no inner man, no intelligent quality, if not anything that lives beyond the death, I've got news for you. We ought to go out and enjoy our life, grab for all the gusto, because when this life is over, it's over. It's just like the old saying, you're like Rover, you're dead all over. If man has no inner quality, and then there is no need for afterlife. And there's no need for resurrection. Because if there's not an inner being of man, there is no need for resurrection. And what did the Bible tell us about that subject in 1 Corinthians 15? If there is no resurrection, then there is no hope. If there is no Christ is not risen, then you're dead in your sins, your faith is futile, and those that have died have perished, and without the resurrection, there is no hope. But if you don't have an inner being, there is no need for a resurrection. Resurrect what? The body? To live upon the earth? Thanks, I've had enough the first time around. I don't want to go around again. We need to understand that there's a second quality of man. You know what man's, one of man's greatest questions is? What happens after death? If there's no spirit, nothing happens after death. Nothing happens after death if there's not a spirit, but there is a spirit, and there is going to be a resurrection. And so there is an inner quality of man, and we need to accept that. Materialism is contrary to truth. You have a spirit. That's what makes you who you are, and that's what makes you the highest of God's creation. And that's what makes you in the image of God. But I want to next talk about man's body. You do have a body of flesh and bones, but the Christian scientists, they have another concept. We were formed out of the dust of the ground that we read in Genesis 2 and verse 7. I want you to turn to Genesis chapter 3. I want you to notice what God did and told us what happened at the end of our life. Genesis 3:19. And in sweat of your face you shall eat bread till you return to the ground. For out of it you were taken, dust you are, and dust you shall return. Now our materialist friends say, well, see, I told you nothing is the body but flesh and blood. It's just dust. No. No, that's not all of it. The flesh and blood, that turns to dust. Where does the spirit go? Ecclesiastes 12 verse 7 says it goes back to God who gave it. And so there's two things that when you die, and when I die, this tabernacle that you see in time will fade and will decay. It's not a pretty picture. It's not pleasant to look at. But over a period of time, if you open a grave and you open the coffin, you will not see the person, you would see dust, because that's what your body is composed of, dust. And when you return, you go back to that which you were created from. That is your fleshly body, and that is going to happen to every one of us, according to Hebrews 9 and verse 27. God gave man both plant and animal life for food, but he forbade blood. Why? In Leviticus chapter 17, verse 11, the Bible principle is taught that in the blood is the source of life. The body appears to be asleep. When somebody dies, it appears to be sleeping. But what is happening is the body is decomposing and it's returning to its natural form. It is natural. It is the way the body was created. It was not made to last forever. It was not given to us that it will last for an eternity. It will last but for a short period of time. But the spirit is very much alive at the point of death. We read that in Lazarus, in the account of Lazarus in Luke chapter 16. When he lifted his eyes up in death, the rich man was in torment, but Lazarus was comforted. There is a happening after death. Remember, in the thief on the cross in Luke chapter 23, what did Jesus tell the thief? Today thou will be with me in paradise. What was it? Was it the thief going to be there? No, the thief's on the cross with Jesus. The thief went to the grave, but something about that thief was going with Jesus to paradise. In Psalms chapter 16, verse 8 through 10, the prophet tells us that Jesus' body would never decompose and return to dust because he would overcome the grave. The fleshly body of Jesus would overcome the grave. And you know, whenever we talk about the resurrection, Jesus said, well, yeah, his spirit resurrected. No, his body resurrected. What did he tell Thomas? Look at my hands. Spirits don't have hands. Look at the hole in my side. A spirit doesn't have a body, a physical body. Jesus said, look at my hands. Look at this hole in my side. It was his body. Jesus had a body. You and I have a body. That's the fleshly part of us. And that's the way that we were created. But the Christian scientist says, and this is a cult that was started by Mary Baker Eddy in 1879. It embraces a philosophical idealism which dismisses the real world as an illusion. Do you know you're living in an illusion? This world's just an illusion. It's really not real. You're really not here. Dust of the ground, man's body is confessed of flesh and bones, and death is said to be an illusion. You know, I've had people close to me die. It wasn't an illusion. They're no longer here. That's not an illusion. That really happened. They left this life. That's not an illusion, folks. That's reality. If such teaching is true, the deeds of the body are mere phantoms of an illusion. Sin isn't real. You're really not committing sin because you're really not here. It's just an illusion. Well, wouldn't that be great? Wouldn't it be great that everything you did is just an illusion? And you're really not here. You're really not breathing. You're really not on the earth. This is just an illusion. This is a mere illusion that God made. If that's true, brethren, I got a question. Somebody explain to me 2 Corinthians 5, verse 10. That says we will all stand before the judgment seat of Christ and we will give an account of the deeds done in this illusion. The things done in the body, whether they be good or whether they be bad. That sound like an illusion to you? Is it you're going to give an account of this illusion? You know why Christian scientists, you know what they do? They want to take away accountability. They want to take away accountability that you're not accountable. Everything you do doesn't really make any difference one way or the other. Well, I'm going to tell you something, brother. That's comforting, but it's false. It's error. You are accountable. God made you that way when He created you from the dust of the ground. Man is accountable as flesh and bones, and he has responsibility. And Christian scientists is something that is contrary to the state of what man really is. Next, let's talk about the creation for a minute. Whenever you talk about the nature of man, you're going to have to get into creation. Man's creation, creation is the Bible account. Evolution is man's theory about how it came about. It says on the sixth day that God created Adam and Eve and man and woman. Man from the dust and woman from the rib of Adam, according to Genesis chapter 2, verse 18 through 23. God made all forms of life, including man, capable of reproducing after its own kind. If you read the biblical account of creation, there's three words that ought to stand out. After its own kind. That's four words, but those are the four words. After its own kind. What does that mean? That means that everything reproduces itself after its own kind. For the evolutionist to be right, there has to be one classification of life. Is there? Is there just one classification of life? Or are there birds and fishes and animals and man? There's more than one type, isn't there? But how do you that so if evolution is the answer? He rested on the seventh day. God created all things at the beginning. It is a fundamental to proper human conduct to accept the account of biblical creation. Let me tell you something, brethren. There's only two ways you can go in this. Either life came from natural causes, or life was created by an intelligent design. It is either one or it is the other. It is either natural cause or it is intelligent design. Now, whenever you get into a discussion with an evolutionist or a Darwin believer, and your children are going to be taught this in school, so you better be able to answer and discuss this with them. And whenever you get into discussion with these folks, they want to say that you have no evidence. That you have no evidence for your proof. Oh, yes, we do. Oh, yes, we do. Let me show you the evidence. Turn to Romans chapter 1. I'll show you our evidence. Don't ever let an evolutionist try to sell you on the bill that you don't have anything but the Bible. That's a lie. That's a lie. Revelation 1, look at verse 20. For since the creation of the world, His invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even His eternal power and Godhead, so they are without excuse. Exhibit A for the creationist is the creation itself. Every evidence that the evolutionist wants to predict and wants to perform, I have that already as my Exhibit A. You know how? Let them explain the order and the design of life. Why does everything produce after its own kind? Ask the evolutionist about origin. All things came from matter. Where did matter come from? Well, it was just here. No, matter had to come from somewhere. Somebody's going to have to answer the question of origin. And you know, when I was in Florida about a month ago, and I went to some lectures by a gospel preacher that also has a PhD in science. And he gave some illustrations, and it was mind-boggling. It's way over my head. But let me give you a couple things to think about. What do you know about the immune system of your body? You know anything about that? Let me tell you something. And let me tell you this. I've read it. I didn't study it. I can't explain it, but I can tell you how it works. You know in the immune system in your body, you know when something foreign goes into your body, that it's automatically attacked by cells in your body, and it's attacked until it is killed and destroyed, and then in your memory bank, it makes a copy of that cell, of that thing that entered your body, and it puts it in a little memory bank, and any time that substance comes back in your body, it's attacked again until it's killed. You know how many of those you've got in your body? Billions. They'll produce millions every day. How does it do that? How does man even know that it does that? How was he able to think that up? The mind that God gave him. But how does it do it? How does our body kill anything that would attack it? How does it do that? And how do I have billions of these things stored in my body in my memory bank? That just happened. That happened because something crawled out of the water and grew feet and arms and began to walk and began to think. Is that how it happened? If you believe in that, I got some good oceanfront property in Las Vegas. I'll sell you if you believe that's how it happened. Brethren, it's a pipe dream. It's a myth. How do you explain the complexity of man? Do you know how much it takes for you to move your fingers? You know how many things have to happen in your body for that to be able to do that simple thing? That just happened? That's just by chance? How much does man know about himself? Very little. You know what the scholars tell me? They say that the average man uses 7% of his brain power, of his brain's capacity. 7%. You know, he's done all kinds of ungodly things for 7%. Maybe in some ways I'm glad he hasn't found the full potential. Don't tell him what he would do. But how is that possible? How do you explain the complexity of man without God? How do you explain design without God? Let me give you an example. Why are we far enough away from the sun that we get its warmth, but we're not close enough that we don't melt? Why is that? And why does it take the earth a complete year to turn around on its axis? That just happened. How do you explain the atmosphere? How do you explain the stars? How do you explain the heavens? How do you explain the design and the intelligence? How do you explain that? The evolution says it just happened. It happened by natural causes. I deny that. You know why I deny that? If I evolved from an ape, I want to see evidence that it happens again. Why is it continuing to happen? You know what? I got in a discussion with evolution. Why did I ask him that question? You know what he told me? He said, well, we're beyond that stage now. Really? When did we get beyond it? When did that stop happening? Well, he couldn't tell me that. Isn't that interesting? We stop, but he doesn't know when, and he really doesn't know when we started. But he knows that we've got beyond that now. Brethren, it either is creation or is evolution. Let me tell you something. However you define this subject is going to have a lot to do with how you look at sin. If you believe the humanist and you believe the evolution theory, then you're nothing more than a hybrid of animal. That's all you are. Why should you act any different? Just act the same way, just on a lower level. And you know what? Take a look around. Man's buying it. Man's accepting it. And he's acting just that way. What is the result of such reasoning? It's the philosophy of self above others. I call it barnyard mortality. And we might makes right in the survival of the fittest. Every man is a law unto himself. Right and wrong is never in an absolute sense and is being replaced by evolving concepts which are ever changing. Godless chaos is the result. Read Romans 1, 18 through 32. And if you want evidence that that's not the result, open up your newspaper this morning. Read it. And see if man not buying in to the creation theory. Instead, he's buying into evolution. He's nothing more than a full-bred, higher breed of an animal. I deny that to be so. God did not create us in the image of a hybrid animal. He created us in the image of God. That makes us different than an animal. And I don't want to break anybody's hearts, but there is no doggy and cat heaven, and there is no animal heaven, because man is the only one that is accountable to God for his conduct. Man is it. Why? Because he is in the image of God. Last point this morning. Your place. For us to truly understand sin, man's place must be known. Man can know his place in this world and utilize the creation about him for his good. Contrary to Eastern beliefs such as Hinduism and Buddhism and others who say that we really can't know what our exact place here is in this life. God ordained man to have dominion. What does dominion mean? That means oversight. That means control. How much of it did he give man? Over everything he created, over every plant, over every living thing, that he had dominion, he was created to subdue it. Understanding God's proper order in the universe is essential to man's finding his proper place in that order and then properly utilizing the creation. One must distinguish ourselves from God and the rest of his creation to understand that. Now, Hinduism and Buddhism, and Hinduism has some 330 million different gods. And Buddhism has no personal God, and all are one. Both tend towards the doctrine of pantheism, which just simply means the worship of many gods. Do not clearly distinguish between an ultimate being from an ordinary existence of all things. God is not personal, being separated from the universe, but he is something of a force. He is the ground of our being. You know what that is? That's New Age religion. That we're just created in the ground of our being. You know what New Age religion says? You're a God. You're a God, but you're a God on a lower level. And over a period of time, you start way down here, but you can end up equal on the same plateau as the God. Well, isn't that interesting? And doesn't that just feed our egos that we're a bunch of little gods, but we have the ability to be a big God? Let me ask you something. If we have that ability, why do we have a beginning? Why do we have an ending if we're a God? Because the term God means eternal. Are you eternal? You know the answer to that. You're not eternal, but God's eternal. How can God, who is eternal, and man, who is temporal, how could they ever be equal? How could that ever be equal? Can't be. The line goes between the creator and the created is blurred. You see, it gets fuzzy. It gets gray. And so you can't really distinguish between God and creation. The blending and blurring of divinity, man, and the universe breaks the mainspring of human activity. Instead of striving to do God's creation, to harvest his blessings ordained by God, man feels he needs to be challenged and not disturb the divine essence found in things all around him. I want to ask you something. Why do men get more upset about the spotted owl, about seals, about the whales, than they do about killing a human child? Because his thinking has gone backwards. That the things that God created for him to do are greater than the life that he gave man to live. Why does man turn that around? Why has man become so interested in his environment, in the things that God gave him to do, more than he is in human life itself? Because he's bought in to evolution, Eastern religious thinking, and he's bought into humanism. That makes everything, you know what Buddhism says? That everything was created for a purpose. So you can't kill the sacred cow. You can't use the manure to put on your fields because it disturbs the order of things. Who did God give those things to benefit? Man. Man's to use them to his benefit. Now, I'll be the first one to admit, man's abused the right that God gave him. There's many things that he does to abuse the authority that God gave him. That does not diminish that God gave him the authority. This world was created for us to use to the good and the glory of God. This world was not created for it to subdue us. But if our friends in the humanistic thinking is right, they would have the world telling us how we should treat the world instead of us using the world for the glory and the benefit of God. Brother, can you not see that that is backwards completely from what God said? Leaving things as they are, we strive to blend the balance between divinity and human nature. Brother, you know what? When I did a lot of meeting work in Oregon. I'm going back there again next month. A few years ago, they had a real big problem with the spotted owl. And the environmentalists decided that they had to quit cutting down the timber in order to save the spotted owl. But you know what? I had some friends in Oregon that worked in the timber industry for over 35 years. You know what he told me? He said, in 35 years, I've never seen a spotted owl. I've never seen a spotted owl in the woods. And you know what I believe? I believe if a spotted owl, which lives in the woods and lives in trees, and if there's a place where there's no trees, you know what I think God gave him the instinct to do? To go somewhere where there is trees. You know why? Because he's instinctive. Because God made him that way. But what do? We close down that lumber industry. We put people out of their homes and out of their jobs so we can protect the spotted owl that still exists in its natural habitat where the word still exists. We're going to save the baby whale. Now, please don't take this as I'm against saving whales, or I'm not concerned about the environment, and I am. But I'm not concerned about it above man, because man is greater. Man is more important. God made it that way. And how do I reconcile, brethren? And here's what I want to leave you with. How do I reconcile man's nature? That he's more worried about his environment, about the animals that live upon this earth, than he is about destroying the beauty and the grandeur of the image of God that he was created with. Something is terribly wrong with our thinking when that becomes more important than our inner quality with God. Brethren, I want to suggest to you this morning that the Bible says that the nature of man is twofold. You have a body of flesh and blood, but you also have an inner quality that is called the soul. It is what makes you what you are. It is your thinking, your intelligence, your emotions, and your power to discern. It comes from your mind, and that is the inner quality, and that's what makes you as the image of God. And it did not just happen. It did not just happen with some great explosion in the universe, and we just, bam, here we are. That didn't happen that way. We were created by an intelligent God who put things in order and put things by design, and he gave them for man to subdue, and the world was created for us. The world wasn't created to subdue us. That's contrary to what the Bible teaches. But brethren, that does not mean that we can abuse the blessings that God gave us with this earth and not live to regret it. We can and we will if we don't stop. But I suggest to you this morning that your place is to remember that you are the highest of all of God's creation. That makes you accountable to your Creator.
That means that you and I will give an account for the things that we've done while we lived upon God's earth. And we will give an account for how we used it and how we used it to His glory or to His dishonor. And we will give an account for that. If you're here this morning and you're not a child of God and you believe that you answer to no one, then you do not understand the simple, basic premise of the Bible. You are accountable. You are answerable. And you do answer to someone. And that someone will be God. Now, you know what the beauty of that is? You don't have to believe it. You don't have to.